In recent days, I've been reading from Drew Gilpin Faust's book, This Republic of Suffering. It's a masterful account of how Americans dealt with death and dying during the American Civil War and immediately thereafter. The war, like all wars, created a large number of dead and dying people. That's what happens in war. But in fact, the Civil War was responsible for the death, and this is a relatively newly adjusted number, the death of 750,000 men. 750,000. Which is greater than the number of dead for all armed conflicts in which the United States engaged, from the Revolutionary War to the current engagement in Afghanistan. One consequence of that terrible toll of death was how to handle the mortal remains of those who were killed. Often in the heat of battle, bodies simply remained on the battlefield. After it was over, the winning side could go out and retrieve their wounded and their dead, but the losing side would have to retreat, and often their dead comrades were either left where they lay or shoveled into mass graves. This was a challenge for Christians in this period of time, because there was a great focus in Christian thinking during that era on dying well, what the medieval spiritual writers called ars moriendi, the art of death. Those medieval writers wrote treatises on good dying during the time of the Black Death, when millions died of the plague. And even in our Anglican tradition, the great divine Jeremy Taylor wrote a wonderful book shortly thereafter called Holy Living, Holy Dying, which addressed this very subject. But the concept of ars moriendi, the good death, was equally potent when the Civil War was raging. Such a good dying in that period of time included these characteristics: being in good relationship with God, being at peace regarding one's death, and sending loving thoughts to those whom the dying person left behind. And so men would often write letters to their loved ones before a battle when they feared that they might die in that battle. And in those letters, they talked about how they knew that death was near and saying that they were ready to be with God and were not afraid, and that their loved ones should know that they would wait for them in the heavenly realm. If they were wounded or died in battle, if such a letter had not been sent, often comrades in arms would write such letters to the families, giving them comfort that they had not been alone, that they had been reconciled to their death, and that they were ready to meet their Maker as children of God. Often a memento, a lock of hair, a picture, something like that would be sent along with the letter, a sense of connectedness, even after death. This was no doubt a great comfort to the families who received such letters, even in the midst of their grief. But one of the continuing sadnesses, one of the great sadnesses for these mourners, was that they would not know where their loved one lay after death. There was often no marked grave, no place where mourners could go and commune with their dead family member. Wives and mothers wrote to the Secretary of War asking about their boy. Was he alive? Was he wounded? Just some news, please, something. And if he was dead, where does he lay? And one of the great works of Clara Barton during that period of time was to advocate and to push hard for a way to keep track of those who had died and their resting place, so as to provide some solace to their families and to end questions about whether or not their brother or son or father was truly dead. If they had received no letter, how would they know? And it was torturous for those who did not know. If one of the hallmarks of the good dying, the ars moriendi, was being at peace with the Lord, another equally important one was that the family was able to lay the person to rest with dignity for his mortal remains, with prayer, with a marking of his final resting place. Thus, many of our Civil War dead on both sides of the battle had the first part of that good dying, being in good relationship with God, being at peace to their fate, but the latter part, a time and place of prayer and commendation with family present and the marking of that place, was often missing. In fact, the federal government worked for a decade beyond the Civil War, seeking out the unmarked graves of those who had died in the battles, so that those who had served and died would be properly accounted for, reinterred, and named on an appropriate marker or headstone. 10 years after the war was ended, the struggle for ars moriendi still consumed the souls and the resources of a nation trying to recover from its wounds. I tell you this story because on Good Friday, we too struggle with ars moriendi as we listen to Jesus' death and burial stories. He died on a political battlefield. Certainly, no one could doubt that his death was as much a battle of Romans and Pharisees against a religious or political reformer that they distrusted and even hated. And his death was not attended by his followers, except for a few of the women who were part of his band, his mother, his aunt, Mary of Magdala. So did Jesus die a peaceful death? Certainly a horrific death. But he seemed resigned to what happened and accepted it with little argument. In other versions of the Passion story, Jesus cries out, seemingly in despair, my God, why have you forsaken me? That powerful line from the beginning of Psalm 22. That we shared together earlier in this service. But in this version, in the Gospel of John, he simply says, it is finished. And then it is over, and his body is taken in the dead of night to a tomb donated by Joseph of Arimathea. No mourners weeping. No priests intoning prayers, no incense, only a little preparation of the body before entombment. Even those women, those faithful women, are not present. Those women who had been the only ones to stand at the foot of the cross. It is simply a gentle disposal of Jesus' body to a safe place, an appropriate place, in a bit of a rush because of the impending Passover feast, but it really does not comport with all of the proper burial rituals of first century Judaism. This is a rush, and the things that you would expect to happen do not happen. So we might conclude that this was not ars moriendi. It was not an artful death, not as good a death as the medieval scholars and the Civil War widows might have envisioned one. It was a lonely death after a hard, hard dying. And perhaps we wonder if Jesus felt abandoned while he was slowly dying on the cross. If he felt like he had failed in his mission, if it was all worth it. But maybe he knew that this was the last good thing that he could do in his earthly body, to complete the prophetic vision, to deliver redemption. And if that was the case, it was the most artful of deaths, true ars moriendi, the one that had the most meaning for all of creation. If we reflect on those primary qualities embodied in ars moriendi, what are they? To be in good relationship with God. No question that Jesus meets this standard. He is the Son of God. And he has fulfilled his mission by dying on the cross. That second quality, to be at peace regarding one's death. Those words, "it is finished," seems to say that he's reconciled to what has happened and accepts that his earthly body is completing its task, sending loving thoughts to one's family. One of the most tender moments in the whole Passion story, Jesus instructing the beloved disciple to treat Mary as his own mother and telling Mary that this disciple would now be her son. Jesus is attending to the business of providing for his mother's welfare once Jesus is gone. There may have been no conventional synagogue service, no traditional burial service with weeping women wearing torn garments, no public symbol of the honor that this man, the Son of Man, deserved at his passing, but for the ironic sign nailed to the cross. But make no mistake, this was ars moriendi in its highest expression. Some of the trappings were missing, but they were merely that, external symbols. What truly mattered in good dying was embodied in this most horrific of deaths. It is good that we meditate on this most holy of deaths and reflect upon what it might mean in our own lives. And there are two directions upon which we might cast our eyes. The first would be on the cross, as we give thanks for Jesus' willingness to suffer and to die for us, to redeem us. The second, and in some ways the harder one, is to look at our own lives. It is in our living, of course, that we understand how we will die. Will we die the good death, knowing that we were in communion with the one who created us and who loves us? Will we die at peace, knowing that we did what we could while we were able to bring the reign of God to our world? Will we die satisfied that we did what we could to attend to our families and our loved ones, that no forgiveness was left undeclared, no thank you left unspoken? No arrangement for those left behind, left unplanned. Most important, will we have lived our lives in a way that pleased God? On this Good Friday, we look up at the cross. We see the dying and exhausted Jesus upon it. We know that no great funeral procession will mark his death, certainly nothing to compare with that procession a mere week ago when he came into Jerusalem. But we know that his message and the procession of followers continues even until today. This is truly a good dying, the one that yields life beyond the grace and beyond the grave. Will your life and your death approach that standard of Ars Moriendi? Amen.